This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Facebook faces its troll problem with postcards, the tax calculator that everyone is waiting for. Yeah, no, really. And Black Panther is just everything. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, February 19th. It is President's Day. Glad you could be with us. When special counsel Robert Mueller indicted 13 Russian companies and people on Friday for criminal interference in U.S. elections, the indictment singled out Facebook as a particularly powerful way to manipulate U.S. citizens with fake pages and posts and highly targeted ad campaigns. Facebook says it's hiring more people to address security and that it will do things like send postcards to verify that potential ad buyers live in the United States. But to those who study the effects of technology on society, there's much more to do. Zeynep Tufekci is an associate professor at the University of North Carolina. Zeynep, thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right. So first of all, Facebook is clearly on the defensive here. Its business model is at the heart of this conversation. So, you know, in your opinion, how much of this does fall on the company's shoulders?
A good deal.
Yeah.
It's not the only player. Obviously, the way our politics is broken, the way the country is polarized, the way that there's demand for this stuff, it's all part of it, and we should not forget about it. But certainly, there's a reason that Facebook was uniquely targeted by purveyors of misinformation and disinformation, because its business model really makes it easy for the stuff to go viral.
Well, and so quickly, let's talk about some of those proposed solutions, the ad verification, the postcards that will attempt to verify advertisers. Do you see that as effective self-regulation?
Well, yes and no. But the core problem for me is that we have a business model that relies on taking as much information about us. Facebook doesn't just collect every click you make on the site. It also buys enormous amounts of information about people. It profiles you. Mm-hmm. And then it sells your attention to advertisers. And to make itself attractive to advertisers, it has algorithms that try to keep you on the site as long as possible. I don't think people realize how much we are profiled and surveilled. And just to make us click on a few ads and just to sell us a few things, I mean, it's really a bad bargain. The upside for me is that these companies are really young. Mm-hmm. Facebook is just 14 years old. When cars were this young, they had no emission controls. They had no airbags. We fixed all that.
Yep.
We can fix this one, too.
So ultimately, you know, this all is going to come down to one question, which is, can Facebook regulate itself or is the government going to have to step in?
I would say that we will need all of it. I can imagine all sorts of ways in which the industry self-regulates too. Other industries do it. It doesn't just have to be government regulation. And if they get to be a state in which there's some meaningful competition, then consumer pressure might work too.
Mm-hmm.
Then all of them could help bring us to a saner place.
Zeynep Tufekci is Associate Professor at the School of Information at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Thank you so much, Zeynep.
Thank you for inviting me.
Something that also might go viral soon, the IRS's new tax calculator. We may have a new tax law on the books, but we don't have a lot of answers about how it's going to impact our actual bottom lines when we file our taxes next year. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin says a new withholding calculator is coming out this week. It's a way for you to check if you're having too much or not enough held back from your paycheck for taxes. And the tool is, for obvious reasons, getting a lot of attention. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has this one.
In some ways, the effects of the new tax law are already showing up in paychecks. Payroll processors got some basic guidelines a couple of weeks ago. Normally, what employers take out matches pretty closely to what people end up owing. But this year, says Peter Eisberg of payroll processor ADP, people should
take the trouble to check it this time because the law has changed dramatically and they might be surprised at the results at the end of the year.
It's one thing to get a bigger-than-expected refund, but Eisberg says some might find they aren't withholding enough to account for changes to the law.
The calculator should help folks put in a number of their tax factors, you know, married, single, whether they plan to deduct mortgage interest to estimate their total tax liability for the year.
Because it's probably changed. This is especially important if someone takes a lot of what are called personal exemptions. On the W-4, the IRS form you give your boss, these are reflected when you answer questions about
how many people in your household? How many children did you had? And based on that, it influenced your withholding situation.
Nicole Kading is director of special projects at the Tax Foundation.
Those personal exemptions have been eliminated under the Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. There were a number of other tax changes that offset that. But because of that, it really is imperative that individuals think through their tax situation and use that calculator.
Which will give you a real picture of how the new tax law will actually affect your paycheck. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today, U.S. markets are closed for President's Day. We'll have the global details when we do the numbers. If you did not see Black Panther this weekend, I'm surprised because kind of everybody else did. The Marvel blockbuster is on pace to end this holiday weekend, having set unprecedented box office records. It has brought in an estimated $235 million and climbing in ticket sales since Thursday. It easily crushed the previous record for highest grossing President's Day weekend. It is actually now the highest grossing film ever released in February, and it's winning in other areas, too. Its companion soundtrack, Black Panther: The Album, debuted at number one on the Billboard charts and is the second highest selling movie soundtrack album ever, thanks in part to its novel approach to distribution. Marketplace's Renata Sago reports.
A typical movie soundtrack captures the essence of what people see on screen. It propels moviegoers to become music consumers, eager to feel the moments of a film well after its release. Black Panther, the album, though, is not typical.
You had a significant amount of excitement and attention on the songs before anybody ever heard them in the movie.
David Bakula is Senior Vice President of Analytics and Client Development at Nielsen Entertainment. The data company found the album posted 139 million on-demand audio streams 1 week before Black Panther, the movie, even opened. That's the biggest streaming week for a soundtrack ever, according to Keith Caulfield, co-director of charts at Billboard. He says the soundtrack's commercial success is thanks to its big-name collaborations and its lead producer, the chart-topping rapper Kendrick Lamar.
It comes into the marketplace with a built-in fan base.
For Jackie Otero, program director for entertainment and music business at Full Sail University, it's about more than just the artists. It's hip-hop itself that's seeing success in music charts right now. She estimates 30% of streamed music is hip-hop.
Hip-hop is the dominant genre. So, you know, you're seeing this increase of streaming. You're seeing hip-hop dominate streaming.
You're also seeing a big cultural moment. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
The companies and pension funds and endowments that invest in venture capital funds are starting to make noise about how that industry needs to clean up its act around diversity and sexual harassment. They don't want to write checks to harassers or enable startups with toxic cultures. And they don't want VCs who might pass on entrepreneurs like Katrina Lake, the CEO of the clothing subscription company Stitch Fix. In 2017, Lake was the only female CEO to take a tech company public in the U.S. Stitch Fix is now valued at nearly $2 billion, but getting there was as hard a road as you might expect. I interviewed Lake on stage at the Women's Leadership Conference called Makers in Los Angeles earlier this month. Here's part of that conversation.
You know, when you look back on that journey and those meetings with venture capitalists, like the number of no's, are we talking it could fill a bathtub or like an Olympic-sized swimming pool?
Actually, I mean, I can tell you how many people said yes, and it's the three people that were investors in Stitch Fix. And I think I have a Google spreadsheet of all of the no's and all of the whys. And yeah, it's probably more in the swimming pool range than a bathtub. It's, you know, 50 plus.
Yeah. Because not only were you a woman founder, you were also pitching a company for women, so double whammy, one assumes. But what were the whys that they would give you?
But the no's were all kinds of no's. It was no, like, I just don't believe this can, I don't know, I just don't believe that many women will shop this way. There was a no where it was like I would come in and I would have a box that was a fix, and like a guy looked at it and was like, I just don't understand why anybody would ever want something like this. Yeah. I appreciate the honesty. I'm like, okay, great. This doesn't seem like a fit. Like, we'll move on and find somebody who's excited about this. There are seed stage no's, which are really around, like, this is a good idea. Are you the right person to execute it? I don't know. The later stage no's are the harder ones. And so, like, the Series B no's of, like, I have a business that is generating millions of dollars. People are waiting 60 or 90 days to get a fix because, like, we don't have the infrastructure to serve, like, the millions of people that this is an attractive proposition for. And I have an amazing team. I have the COO of Walmart.com, who's my COO, and the guy who ran all of algorithms at Netflix, it, like, runs all of algorithms at Stitch Fix. Like, clients love it, and they're waiting, like, to get the service. And yet, people were like, I just can't get excited about it.
Yeah.
And, like, those were really hard because it was like, I knew that I was pitching a female-oriented product to a very male-oriented audience, and so I was the entrepreneur more than anybody they've ever met that knew my numbers inside and out. And, like, you can make a lot of money doing this. And, like, it was hard.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things we've been talking about a lot and that has really been a theme in this conference is using your power once you get it, you know, and how do you become not just a successful CEO, but someone who is influencing the people around you and sometimes saying things that they have never heard before. Tell us your hot tub story. I mean, this is just, you know, when you think about culture and how deep some of this stuff goes, you've got sort of a perfect example of the, being the only woman in the room.
I couldn't have been the only woman in the room, but I was at a conference that was like actually kind of like this size. It wasn't a huge conference. And there is a VC who is being interviewed. Well, Chris Sacco is being interviewed up there. I've already outed his name on there. But Chris Sacco is being interviewed, and he was like, I have a very untraditional approach to VC. Like, I don't even live in the city. I don't even have an office. I live up in Tahoe. And, like, you know, I invite entrepreneurs up to my place in Tahoe, and I have them tell me about their company over beers in the hot tub. And I can get to know them, you know, kind of more as humans that way. And I was, like, sitting in the audience, like, literally pregnant. You're asking people to come pitch you in a swimsuit, and, like, I'm literally pregnant, and I actually can't come into your hot tub, and I actually can't drink your beers.
Yeah.
And I was in a room with, like, hundreds of people, and maybe they were all thinking the same thing. I don't know if they were or they weren't, but, like, it was stated out loud. It wasn't tweeted. It wasn't controversial. Mm-hmm. And this was, you know, 2 years ago.
Yeah. Well, you know. Now, when given your opportunity, you did go after some of your colleagues over, you know, they're over Uber, right? And that toxic culture.
Yeah. And so, you know, as we segue into the, like, now what, there's two things that I think are big things that we can all, or that some of us can do. And then there's a bunch of little things that, like, every single one of us can do every single day. One thing is around using a market-based pay approach. And so that's one thing that we did at Stitch Fix where it's not perfect. It's still, like, you know, there's still imperfections in it. There's still challenges with it. But if you use a market-based pay approach and you're looking at people blindly based on their years of experience and their responsibilities, and you're not looking at who is the squeakiest wheel and who yells the loudest, it's a much better place to start from. So if you're in a position where you can implement that at your company or you can push for it, I would encourage that. I'm in a place now where I am able to have, like, a direct line to more people. And so I'll have, like, a big and small way to talk about this. But I think in the big way, Bill Gurley is an investor in Stitch Fix. He was on the board at Uber for a very long time. When the whole Uber culture stuff started coming out, like, I was just kind of appalled and horrified, and like, you know, like many of you probably were too, of like, I can't believe this company culture like exists today in 2017. And so I wrote Bill like a strongly worded email. And like in that moment, and what I've realized is like, there are all these decisions that you can make where, like, what's the worst thing that can happen? Like, the worst thing that can happen is that Bill says like, thank you, I respect your opinion, but I'm good. Like, the worst thing that can happen is nothing. And the best thing that could happen was that I could have been the straw that broke the camel's back that caused Benchmark to do something. I just remember my second thing too. We can all do this. So, you know, when you RFP, like you're like, okay, I need a new ad agency, or I need an investment bank, and you send out RFPs and you say, tell me a little bit about like what your capabilities are. What would your strategy be? Ask about gender and diversity metrics. So I asked, when we worked with investment banks, I asked them, can you share your gender and diversity metrics for your VP and above people in your investment banking division? Look, to be honest, like that wasn't like the main decision criteria, but people had to go and talk to the head of investment banking. They had to go get the data. Then they had to explain the data and say like, why is this not what we would hope it is? And what are we doing about it? And so if nothing else, I created conversations in all of these places that maybe would not have happened. And that's something that I think all of us can do in our day to day as kind of the decision makers that we are.
Katrina Lake, CEO of Stitch Fix, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was, once again, Katrina Lake, the CEO of Stitch Fix. Side note, that VC she mentioned, Chris Acca, he posted an apology to female entrepreneurs back in June for helping to create an unequal tech culture. He did not mention the hot tub. Coming up,
you start making plans for a future. Me and my husband, we got married, and then here it was that we found ourselves struggling.
More stories of how the financial crisis changed us. But first, let's do the numbers. Here in the U.S., markets were closed for President's Day. China's markets were closed today for Lunar New Year. In Japan, the Nikkei was up 1.9%. European stocks closed lower. Germany's DAX down 0.5%. France's CAC 40 was off 0.4%. Britain's FTSE fell 0.6%. In Europe, steel firms that also have facilities in the United States moved higher. That follows the Commerce Department's recommendation Friday that foreign steel producers should be subjected to heavy tariffs or quotas. Luxembourg's ArcelorMittal shined up 1.25%. U.S. bond markets were closed for the holiday. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood.
A couple of weeks ago on this show, we told you about some of the funding and resources available for mass shooting victims to help with their short-term recovery. That was before yet another mass shooting in this country, this time in a Florida high school. With each one, like in a Texas church last November, the Las Vegas concert last October, a new community has to learn to live with what's happened there. Today, we consider what life and work is like 5 or even 10 years after surviving a high-profile shooting. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson talked with two of those survivors, and a warning for those listening, these stories may be upsetting.
It's been a while now since Susan Helper has told the story of that Friday afternoon back in 2003 when she was shot in her office at Case Western Reserve University.
I looked up and I saw 5 feet away this shooter with an assault rifle aiming at me. It was like he was operating a garden hose. He was just so calm as he did this.
Susan's an economics professor. It was the end of the school year, pretty quiet on campus. The shooter was a graduate of the school, but Susan didn't know him. He just saw her and fired right as she shut her office door. That likely saved her.
The bullet came through the door and then hit me in the chest and bounced onto my arm. And then I spent the next 4 hours or so in my closet.
Until the police could arrest the shooter and escort her out. The bullet hit bone. It left a big bruise and a scar, but Susan was lucky, if that's the right word.
It took a couple weeks for the physical injury to go away. I wasn't prepared for how long it would take for the diminishing of the mental issues.
After the euphoria of surviving wore off, she says this fog set in. She was anxious and irritable. It was hard to plan even basic things. She didn't go to work much that summer.
I did teach my classes in the fall. It was still difficult to kind of concentrate on research or writing in a long paper.
Research is a really important part of her job, but Susan says she wasn't able to publish for about 3 years after the shooting.
There was a kind of research that I was maybe more of a pioneer of and kind of lost that lead. Certainly some projects that were no longer timely, and so I kind of dropped them.
Now, Susan's still a really successful professor. And she even thinks the shooting made her a better, more empathetic teacher. Even so, 15 years later, the sound of gunshots or loud noises still makes her feel personally at risk in a way she knows isn't rational. She goes to Canada every 4th of July to avoid fireworks.
And then when I read about mass shootings, which seems to happen pretty frequently, again, I feel personally in danger, maybe in a way that I wouldn't have.
That's a feeling many survivors echo, including Manira Gravelli, who survived the shooting in an Aurora, Colorado movie theater back in 2012. She talked about her experience over Skype. It was a midnight showing of a Batman movie, and Manira went with some of her coworkers, including Jesse Childress. He died while shielding her.
We had to leave him in the theater. He was shot and he was on the ground.
Manira had met Jesse at work just a month earlier. She works in IT for the U.S. Air Force, and they got along really well, had a lot of the same interests, like anime and superhero movies. Still, she says she didn't really know him well.
And that's the part that it bothered me for the longest time. It seemed really weird to miss him that much.
Munira was stationed in Colorado for 3 years, and she says she didn't realize how much she wanted to leave until she was finally transferred to a new job in California. She's still with the Air Force, still really loves the work, she's good at it. But she says the shooting's always present. Sometimes the thought of Jesse will flash through her head and she'll start tearing up.
The Air Force facility I work on tests a lot of aircraft. And, you know, when they take off or land or break the sound barrier, you get a nice big boom and it shakes all the buildings. And that is unsettling.
And even 5.5 years later, she says she's still a little paranoid. Like, she won't leave sharp objects out in the house in case someone were to break in. She knows it's illogical, but she does it anyway. She doesn't like to tell people, even coworkers, where she lives.
I'm not really sure why either. It's not like I suspect everybody of being a potential shooter. But now I don't know. It's like I don't want to give anybody a chance to be that either.
At some point, Manira realized she's not really going to get over the shooting, so she had to find a place to put it in order to control how much it affects her.
It's okay if you're still a little messed up forever by what happened. You still have your life. You can still find a way to live it happily. It's just going to be different from before.
The shooting, it's a part of her now. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
This year, as you know, marks the 10-year anniversary since the financial crisis hit. And so across Marketplace, we're spending the whole year talking about how that decade changed us. It's a series we're calling Divided Decade. We're going to hear from a woman named Latrice Collins. Today, she works at a hospital in Santa Monica, but that wasn't the case in 2008.
I was working for my cousin. It was Greg Bell Trucking. And when the market crashed, it caused her business to go out. And I ended up being unemployed. I was unemployed for about 5 or 6 months. It was hurtful because I was out of a job, and it was Christmas time, and it hurt it. I still had kids. We got through it, but it was a hard time of the year. I've been working ever since I got out of high school, even in high school, my senior year. And, you know, you start working, you start making plans for a future. Me and my husband, we got married, and then here it was that we found ourselves struggling. You always told if you work, then you can make things happen. And here we were, where we were struggling. I think we even had car issues that we couldn't even get fixed. And I remember when I did get a little money, I was catching the bus to shop for Christmas to try to make it happen. It changed me to not take life for granted and be appreciative of what you have, and you need to save for a rainy day. I bounced back, but not fully. It's better from the struggle we were at when I was laid off, but times still haven't changed. They're getting worse.
We've got a picture of Latrice Collins on our Instagram. We are at Marketplace APM. And we want to hear your stories. Please tell us how the financial crisis changed you. We're using the hashtag #HowWeChanged. And this final note before we go, a little something I think we could all use. Today marks the 50th anniversary of the first airing of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood on PBS, the man who liked us just the way we are. The guy who said, and I am paraphrasing here, that the three ways to ultimate success are 1, 2, and 3, to be kind. Thanks, Mr. Rogers.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine?
All right, U.S. markets were closed today. We'll have numbers for you tomorrow. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Molly Wood. Kai Rizdahl's back tomorrow. Thanks for listening. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.